Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. In 1779, George Washington said of the American Revolution, quote, "Our cause is noble, it is the cause of mankind, and the danger to it springs from ourselves," end quote. That observation by Washington serves as the epigraph to historian Rick Atkinson's latest book, The Fate of the Day, The War for America, Fort Ticonderoga to Charleston, 1777 to 1780. The book is the second volume in a planned trilogy. The first book, The British Are Coming, was published in 2019. The eminent historian Joseph J. Ellis, writing in the New York Times, summed up the book's narrative power this way, quote, "To say that Atkinson can tell a story is like saying Sinatra can sing," end quote. The Fate of the Day, published last spring, debuted at the top of the bestseller list. It, too, has garnered generous praise. In his spare time, Atkinson has spent the past several years helping Ken Burns with The American Revolution, the 12-hour PBS documentary coinciding with the 250th anniversary of the beginning of the war and the founding of America. Atkinson also appears extensively throughout the documentary. He is the first and last talking head in the 6-part film.
America is predicated on an idea that should act as a pole star for us to provide true north, telling us what it is that we think we can do as a people. The perpetual challenge of the American experiment is to draw on those aspirational ideals, make them our own, hand them off to our children and our grandchildren, and to use that as a propulsion system for being the nation that those forebears thought we could become.
Rick Atkinson joins me today to talk about all things Revolutionary War. Rick, welcome to Charlotte Talks, coming to you from the place Lord Cornwallis described as a hornet's nest of rebellion.
Yeah, thank you, Eric. I'm coming to you from Washington, D.C., which is its own kind of hornet's nest.
Fair enough. As you no doubt know, the name of our city and county, Mecklenburg, honor the German princess who married King George and bore him 15 children. You aware of that?
Yes, I am. That in Charlottesville and various other places that honored the queen that way.
And to finish with the home cooking flavored matters, before I go any further, I want to point out that you earned your undergraduate degree at East Carolina. Go Pirates. And I want to ask you how and why you chose ECU for college.
Gosh, it was a long time ago. Basically, in a nutshell, I had an appointment to West Point, class of 1974. I would have been a classmate of David Petraeus's, and decided at the very last minute I didn't want to go for various reasons, including the fact there were no women there. Every student, every cadet had to get a degree in engineering, a BS in engineering. That was not my long suit. And, you know, at the age of 17, I hadn't given it a whole lot of thought. In the last minute, I decided I was not going to. My father was an Army officer, so it had seemed the path of least resistance. And East Carolina offered me a scholarship, so I ended up in Greenville.
There we go. All right, back to the Revolutionary War. Let's listen to Ken Burns explaining his interest in what became a 12-hour documentary on the nation's founding.
I'm interested in the U.S., but I'm interested in us. And too often, I think our history books have presented a kind of top-down history. Nothing wrong with it. The most important person in our story is, without a doubt, George Washington, and I will defend that to the end. We don't have a country without him. But there are lots of people who contribute to this, bottom-up stories. And if you're going to tell that, you got to be faithful to the whole cast of characters.
So, Rick, how did you become part of this film, both as an on-air expert and as an advisor?
Ken's team at Florentine Films contacted me probably 5 or 6 years ago at this point. I think it was before volume one of my trilogy had been published. They had been at it since about 2015. They knew that I was working on it when the British Are Coming, Volume 1, came out in 2019. I think they recognized that we were basically on the same path, had similar ambitions, that I knew a fair amount about the subject. So they contacted me. I read scripts for them. Then I appeared on camera at some length. I looked at the rough cut of the film well over a year ago now in New York. And then since March or so, I've been traveling periodically with Ken and Sarah Botstein and David Schmidt, is two director-producers, to help promote the thing, partly to buck up the troops at PBS and to rally the cause. So I've gotten to know them quite well and have really enjoyed their company. And I have to say that the film that they have produced on PBS is fantastic.
As you just mentioned, that you've spent a lot of time out promoting the documentary with Ken and Sarah and David. As you've traveled the country and you've been speaking to audiences, what has the response been and what do people ask you about? What do they want to know?
Well, as you might expect, the response, and he and I are preaching to a captive audience to some extent, but we've been at places like the Old Theater in Albany where 3,000 or 4,000 people showed up. We were at Mount Vernon a couple weeks ago, and they had 4,000 people there watching clip excerpts from the film outdoors, big crowds in Richmond and so on. And they're very enthusiastic. They're enthusiastic about the filmmaking that he does. They're enthusiastic about this film in particular, what they have seen of it, what they were allowed to see of it. The questions have been across the board, interesting, probing, puzzled, trying to connect the dots, as you always hope your audience does, whether it's the audience for a film or audience for a book, trying to connect the dots between something that happened 250 years ago and where we are today. Not directly asking for reflections on the Trump presidency versus the American Revolution, but what is it that they were fighting for? And my belief is, and I think Ken shares this belief, is the story of the revolution, our creation story, tells us a lot about who we are, where we came from, what our forebears believed, and what they were willing to die for, which is the most profound question any people can ask themselves. And by forebears, I mean that regardless of whether your family came here 300 years ago, whether your family came here last year, we're all basically derived from the same stuff as Americans. And so the through line from the revolution beginning in 1775 and fought for 8 very difficult years to today is pretty bright, pretty clear, and I think pretty relevant to where we are in 2025.
That's the voice of Rick Atkinson. His new book is called The Fate of the Day. Now, you've written about the military and history throughout your career, first as a journalist, later as a full-time historian. I think your first book was about Vietnam. You published the trilogy on World War II. What led you all the way back to the Revolutionary War?
Yeah, Eric, you know, as I finished that trilogy on the American role in the liberation of Europe in World War II, even before the third and final volume was published in 2013, I was thinking about what to do next. The obvious thing would have been to pivot to the Pacific and do for that theater what I had done for the Mediterranean and Western Europe. But I, after almost 15 years of working on it, I didn't have the heart for it, frankly. I'm a Europeanist. The Pacific didn't have the same hold on my imagination. I kept thinking of Jack London's advice that a writer ought not sit back and wait for inspiration to strike, but should light out after it with a club instead. And I took my club, and what I found was a story that's really captivated me since I was a kid, and that is the American Revolution. I can remember as an eighth grader at George S. Patton Junior High School, Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, where my father was an Army major at the time, encountering Benedict Arnold for the first time. And, you know, what a extraordinary, tortured, tragic figure he is. And even at the age of 13, you can recognize that. And I think his story and the larger story of the revolution, the drama of the revolution, the improbability of it all stuck with me henceforth. And you're right, I've written 8 books. So, you know, given the opportunity to write about what I want to write about, I decided that the American Revolution is where I wanted to go, and to devote what will probably be another 15 years of my life to this story, this epic story, which is really unparalleled in not only American history, but in world history. Ken says it's the greatest event. The American Revolution was the greatest event since the birth of Christ. I'm not sure I would go quite that far, but I think it's really important in determining the shape of global culture, not just the evolution of what would become the Republic of the United States.
You mentioned a couple of times your father served. You thought about going to West Point. Was military history a big part of your growing up? Because there are plenty of people that go through the military and may not necessarily be interested in tactics and in history of their own profession.
Yes. You know, I'm immersed in it growing up, moving from military post to military post in the 1950s and 1960s. At that time, there were still plenty of World War II veterans around, my father among them, and Korean War veterans and ultimately Vietnam veterans. Again, my father among them. I understood the culture. I speak the language. I understand the acronyms. I know the difference between an F-16 and an M-16. I became a journalist somewhat by default, as many do. I had no skills otherwise. And almost from the beginning, particularly after I got to the Washington Post in 1983, I was given assignments that had a military twist to them, partly because of my background. Reporters my age and younger were not subjected to the draft and therefore did not have that kind of direct knowledge of that culture, of the military life that I did as a consequence of being an Army brat. So I just tended to gravitate toward it. I remain interested in it. I think it's a vital part of our national story. The fact that I write about war, the fact that anybody writes about war doesn't mean you like war, quite the contrary. Having been a foreign correspondent, a war correspondent, I can assure everyone that it's horrible. And that's one of the ambitions that I have, is to convey the awfulness of it. And that includes the revolution. In retrospect, we have kind of a hazy, faded lithograph view of the revolution. And it was not like that. It was our first civil war, particularly in the South, where most of the wars fought the last couple of years. And I think it's important for people to know that.
And to that point, Rick, I want to play a clip of you talking about the intensity of that war.
A shot rings out. No one knows where the shot came from. That leads to promiscuous shooting, mostly by the British. It's not a battle, it's not a skirmish, it's a massacre.
With that, we're going to leave you with a cliffhanger to find out how the Revolutionary War ends up. We're going to have much more with Rick Atkinson, the author of The Fate of the Day, coming up right here next on Charlotte Talks. Stay with us.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcltregion.org.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. My guest is historian Rick Atkinson. His is one of the most prominent voices in the Ken Burns documentary, The American Revolution. And that's only his side hustle. Atkinson's day job is writing deeply researched nonfiction. His latest book is The Fate of the Day. You were just talking, Rick, when we went to the break, about the actual horror of the Revolutionary War, which is, I guess, as Ken Burns often says, because of the breeches and the wigs and the lack of video, we think of it in these gauzy terms. Why was it important to you to convey the actual terror and tenor of this war, and also how challenging was it to bring that to the fore?
Yeah, Eric, I think for one reason, I think people ought to recognize the sacrifice that's made. We think of 16.4 million Americans in uniform in World War II, and there's no doubt of the sacrifice they made. We think of those serving in the contemporary military, and we say, thank you for your service. We know that they are making sacrifices, their families are making sacrifices. It's no different for the revolutionary generation. In some ways, those sacrifices are even greater because the war lasts for 8 years, and it's pretty miserable throughout. You know, I also think that it's important for Americans to know that this country was born in violence. The violence of the revolution was extraordinary. There were, among other things, because it's a civil war, it has all the nastiness that every civil war does. It anticipates the civil war for us in the internecine fury of American on American. There's lots of extrajudicial killing. There's lots of really bad behavior by all sides. And I think that, you know, as our stereotype tends to hold up the George Washingtons and the Thomas Jeffersons as marble men without feet of clay, who are basically without flaws, that's untrue. And the notion that the revolution is somehow pristine and there's a bit of biffing going on with muskets and that's that, that is also not true, because the reality of every war is dead boys and sobbing mothers. And it's important to know that, you know, the country's origins are part and parcel of that.
Along those lines, in The Fate of the Day, you write, quote, "Eyes watered from the sharp stink of burned powder. Men tore open cartridges with their teeth, blackening lips and chins, before sprinkling a few grains into the priming pan and tamping home another round. The greasy powder residue on metal ramrods soon blackened hands as well," end quote. That shows some of the discomfort, to use a very mild term for what's going on. But how much do you think sheer fatigue affected battle results in progress?
Oh, gosh, yes, a lot, as it does in every war. You know, one of the things that I know from having been, for example, with the 101st Airborne Division during the invasion of Iraq in 2003 is the importance of what the Army today calls sleep discipline. If you're not getting enough sleep, you're making bad decisions, and making bad decisions in war gets soldiers killed. Fatigue is an enormous part of it, as is boredom. That's the other part. A good part of a soldier's life is sitting around waiting for nothing to happen. So, you know, I try to capture this. I try to give the reader a granular feel for what it was like. I want them not only to see it in the mind's eye, I want them to hear it and to smell it. That's part of the narrative art, I think. And I think it helps a reader to understand just how perilous that life is, not only from gunfire, but from typhus, smallpox, dysentery. How hungry they often were, going for days without any decent food. All of this is part of the soldiering life in the 1770s.
You mentioned a few minutes ago that you'll probably end up spending 15 years on this trilogy. As I mentioned, the first book, The British Are Coming, came out in 2019. Obviously, this year, 2025, we have The Fate of the Day, and you have one more to do. And I want to ask you a question that I hear a lot of people asking Ken Burns, which is, he spent a decade on this 12-hour film, and they ask him about the irony of spending longer on a film than the war actually lasted. So you're going to do that and then some. So I'm wondering, have you turned to Robert Caro for counseling on how to cope with such an investment in a historical project?
We all want Bob to finish that fifth volume, don't we? I've got a few years on him, and Ken had a few extra hands helping him. I don't know what his excuse is for taking 10 years, other than it takes a decade to produce a gorgeous 12-hour film. It takes as long as it takes, and I do almost all of my own research myself, which is my excuse for taking as long. It has to go through my eyes and my brain somehow in order to really sink in and for me to really understand the story. And I'm older and slower now than when I started this project, so I have no illusions that this third volume is going to be any quicker than the first two.
At this point, are there days when you wake up and think, I'm all revolutionaried out, no more tricorns?
Happily, not yet. I hope that day doesn't come for a while. This is my ninth book that I'm working on now, this third volume. So I know that at every point in every book, every author has a moment when at least you hate it. And you wonder what you've gotten yourself into. I don't have those moments very often because I have the privilege of pursuing this great story and doing something that I really love to do. The mystery of the next unopened archival box gets me up in the morning. I am an archive rat. I'm quite comfortable with solitude, which is the lot of an author. You're with your own company a good part of your life. And now I want to see how the damn story ends.
No spoilers. That's the voice of Rick Atkinson. His new book is called The Fate of the Day. Speaking of spending perhaps more time than expected on a project or an endeavor, the British Army could relate.
War never follows the script that you have written for it when you set out to make war. The British objective is first and foremost to suppress the rebellion. It's to teach the rascals a lesson. It's to force them to acknowledge the primacy of Parliament and the authority of the king. And so now the decision has been made that we will use force. And there's a presumption that it won't take much. But it's going to go on for 8 years. 8 years, blood, treasure, catastrophe, really, for the British Empire.
What did they fail to grasp about this war?
Yeah, that's a great question, Eric. They failed to grasp a lot. They operated under several strategic misconceptions, and they needed a short, quick war because Britain was deeply in debt from the previous war, the 7 Years' War, the French and Indian Wars, we call it, which had been a great triumph for Britain over France and Spain. It's how Britain got Canada. It's how Britain got a half billion fertile acres west of the Appalachian Mountains. It's how they got even more sugar islands in the West Indies, where the real money was, parts of India. But the clock was ticking, and they're looking over their shoulder at the French, who have grievances as a consequence of that earlier defeat. Britain really does not want it to turn into a global war, which, of course, it's going to. It's going to be fought ultimately, not just on the 13 colonies, the states along the eastern seaboard, but on four continents in the seven seas. The British assumed that superior British firepower would intimidate the obstreperous rascals and cause them to capitulate. That the 12 other colonies, seeing what was happening to Massachusetts, would kowtow. Well, it didn't. It infuriated them, and they said, if it could happen to them, it can happen to us. The British also believed that there was a much broader and deeper reservoir of loyalists, people, Americans still loyal to the crown, which was not true. And they believed, and this was a real strategic mistake, that if the American colonies were permitted to win their independence and to slip away from the British Empire, that it would encourage insurrections in Canada, in Ireland, in those sugar islands in the West Indies, and it would be the beginning of the end of the first British Empire. That was not true, as fate would show. But all of those misconceptions combined led them down a ruinous path, as it turned out, a path that cost them a lot of blood, a lot of money, and cost them a half a million square miles of British territory.
So almost like a Vietnam domino theory?
Exactly right. The domino theory did not originate in Vietnam, nor did the phrase winning hearts and minds. That phrase was coined by General Henry Clinton, who was the British commander-in-chief in America during the war for 4 years, longer than any other British general. And he talked about the need to win hearts and minds. He couldn't figure it out any better than we could in Vietnam.
You just mentioned in that clip, 8 years of blood and catastrophe. I don't think it can ever be overstated to those of us who haven't served or witnessed military battle how endlessly awful it is, as you mentioned earlier. So in The Fate of the Day, you write, quote, "The medicos did their inadequate best, pressing extruded intestines back into the viscera with two forefingers, enlarging bayonet wounds in the chest to allow pooling blood to drain, and amputating compound fractures with a screw tourniquet, a bone saw, and ligatures of waxed shoemaker's thread," end quote. As someone very familiar with war and battle up close, how hard was it for you to make sense of this scale of suffering in this particular war?
Well, you know, 18th century medicine is hardly worthy of the name. It's very primitive. Of course, they don't understand disease, germ theory. There's very little that they do understand about the human body. And consequently, the treatment for any ailment, whether it's incurred on the battlefield or sickness or whatever, tends to be quite primitive. And, you know, trying to remind myself of that every day as I'm living with these people and the catastrophes that are befalling them, I think is an important part of understanding the story. The, you know, if you're shot in the torso, your chances of living, of recovering, are about 50%. If you're shot in the gut, you're almost certain to die because of the contamination of the chest cavity. You know, you see the suffering. There's no real amelioration for pain. They have some opium, but those are very limited supplies, and it's of limited efficacy. A swig of rum is basically what you're taking as you're having your arm amputated, or biting down on a bullet or a piece of wood. So the suffering is extraordinary. It's not restricted to those on the battlefield. We see it because disease is such a prominent killer. Smallpox, known as the King of Terrors, absolutely destroys the American army that invades Canada in 1775. And smallpox is called the King of Terrors because it is really terrifying. It's a terrible way to die. It's a great destroyer of armies, along with typhus. Trying to ward it off, trying to survive it for Washington, trying to keep his army from being destroyed by smallpox is a very important part of his generalship.
That's the voice of Rick Atkinson. His new book is called The Fate of the Day. Veering over to the opposite end of the spectrum, this book begins with some delightful scene setting in France, America's future ally. You write about Marie Antoinette, whose love of gambling inspired her brother-in-law to derisively dub her Madame Deficit. You detail Ben Franklin's diplomatic adventures, including the British ambassador to Versailles, who described Franklin as a lying, insincere flatterer. What ultimately pulls these disparate people and nations together?
Yeah, boy, it's the key question in the spring of 1777, which is when this book opens, because the game for the Americans, now 2 years into the war, is to persuade the Roman Catholic absolute monarchy of Louis XVI, the king of France, to throw in his lot, provide an army and a navy in addition to muskets and other munitions, with Protestant wannabe Republicans intent on armed rebellion against their lawful monarch. That's a, that's a heavy lift diplomatically. Well, fortunately, we've got our first and greatest diplomat in Paris, trotting off to Versailles frequently, to do that lift, and that's Benjamin Franklin. So I introduce this cast of characters at the beginning of the second book, including a spindly 19-year-old redhead named Gilbert Dumontier, whom you know better as the Marquis de Lafayette, who is just leaving against the king's orders because he's bought a ship. He's one of the richest boys in France, bought a ship, and he's sailing to America because he's aflame with enthusiasm for the American cause. So all these folks are coming together at one time in France to launch us into our story as Volume 2 begins.
I'm curious, it's such a huge cast of characters. How do you begin to manage not only the events, but the people and how you're going to highlight and when you're going to highlight them?
Well, that's part of the narrative art, I suppose. I've got, you know, there's certain inescapable characters. Ken Burns mentions that, you know, Washington is the long pole in the tent. He is proverbially the indispensable man. I lived with Dwight Eisenhower for almost 15 years. I've got the same cheek by jowl relationship metaphorically with Washington. The characters present themselves as they are important in the story. And then you're also trying to tease out those who are certainly far less known, including people who leave very light footprints, if any footprints at all. And that includes women. That includes 500,000 enslaved blacks. It's one in five of all Americans in the 13 colonies when the revolution begins. It includes Native Americans. Their story is largely undertold and always will be, frankly, because it's very hard to tease them out of the historical record. But I try, and Ken certainly tries very hard in the film that is about to debut.
We will have much more coming up with Rick Atkinson. He is the author of the new book, The Fate of the Day. He's also one of the star talking heads in Ken Burns' American Revolution documentary. Stay with us right here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the Gambrill Center at Queens, presenting author Robin Wall Kimmerer, known for braiding sweetgrass and the service berry, sharing perspectives on Indigenous knowledge and ecology on December 2nd at the Gambrill Center. More at gambrillcenter.org.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. We are continuing our conversation with Rick Atkinson. His new book is called The Fate of the Day. It's the second volume in a planned trilogy on the Revolutionary War. He is also one of the featured experts in Ken Burns' documentary, The American Revolution. Before we go too much farther, Rick, I'm curious, do you have a title yet for the third book, and do you have any idea when it might appear?
You sound like a publisher. I don't have a title yet. Sometimes it's, you know, the last or one of the last things you come up with. As I get deeper into the research, various options will occur to me, but I don't have one yet. You know, my guess is that because the first two books each took about 6 years for research, writing, publishing, this one will be the same. If I have it done for the 250th anniversary of Yorktown, which is October of 2031, which to me is only tomorrow, I will be happy. As I said, I'm older and slower, so I'm not any quicker than I was when I started this.
In terms of the first two books, let's see, I think the first one's roughly 570 pages of narrative, and I'm just finished with the other one, which is a little bit longer, The Fate of the Day. That's a roundabout way of me asking you, do you expect it to be of similar length as you tell the end of the war? And I'm really wondering how far you're going to go past Yorktown, because, you know, the demarcation will be an interesting choice for you.
Yeah, you're right. And I have thought about that already. I won't go far beyond Yorktown, but there are a lot of loose ends to tie up. After Yorktown, people think to the extent they know the story at all, that the war ends in October 1781. It does not. The fighting continues, although in a minor key. But the diplomatic fighting goes on for two more years, and it's quite interesting. It's, you know, one of the reasons why the new United States of America had its western boundary at the Mississippi River. There's a lot of scuffling over that. I'm not going to belabor it more than I have to. I don't write short, as you've noted, and there's a lot that happens in this third book, including most of the fighting is in the South at this point, and we've got battles like Kings Mountain and Cowpens and Guilford Courthouse, in addition to Yorktown, the ultimate defeat for the British army. Washington is a large figure, but he's overshadowed on the battlefield, certainly, by the guy who is on the battlefield, and that's Nathanael Greene, who is second only to Washington as that indispensable man for the Americans in the Revolution. And Greene is the battlefield commander in the South, having put in 2.5 years as quartermaster general, a job he just hated, and but was quite good at it. And when the war shifts to the South, when Charleston is captured by the British, after Savannah is captured by the British, the American army in Charleston is destroyed, 5,000 men killed or captured, and things are looking pretty grim. You know, another American army is routed at Camden in South Carolina. A lot of it swirling around Charlotte, of course. And Charlotte's a, you know, tiny village with a courthouse. And you know, a lot of the maneuvering that goes on is in the Piedmont. And so at any rate, my ambition is to have the book not be any longer and hopefully be shorter than the previous two.
Wow, you heard it here first. It'll go through the Clinton administration. Rick, you mentioned this part of the country is a prominent part of that history. I'm wondering how much you have traveled to this area, researching the books, or if you plan future travels to this area as you finish up.
Oh, I definitely will. Having gone to college in North Carolina, I'm aware of the accent. I'm aware of barbecue. I'm aware of basketball. You know, I've not done all the traveling that I need to and plan to. I've never been to Cowpens. I've never been to Kings Mountain. I've been to Guilford Courthouse. But they're on my list. I always go and walk the ground, sometimes more than once. I've got a gig, a visiting professorship at Duke, starting in the new year. So I will be down in Durham at least several times, and I plan to use that opportunity to do some of the on-foot exploration that I want to do, that I need to do over the next year.
Since we've wandered along the path of travels and this territory and the historic sites and walking the grounds, I'm curious if someone it becomes very interested in this topic, as everyone is right now with the documentary and your books and all these things going on, anniversaries. What would be maybe a site in North or South Carolina that you would recommend? And then one in the Northeast that you think is particularly resonant?
Well, let's start with the latter first. I was just in Brandywine. I've been to Brandywine, which is quite interesting. It's southeast of Philadelphia, and there was a battle, a disastrous battle there. Washington, again, showed that often he was not a particularly good tactician. But I was just in Germantown at LaSalle University two nights ago, and there was another battle right after Brandywine at Germantown, where Washington, having been drubbed, decided to launch a surprise attack. And the centerpiece of that battle is a place called Cliveden. It's a manor house, the finest house in Germantown at the time, also known as the Chew House, because it was owned by Benjamin Chew, who was a loyalist who had been on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. The British holed up about 100 men, barricaded themselves in that house, and stopped the momentum of the American attack. It's still there. With bullet holes and cannon scars on the outside, because it was a real fortress. It's really a very interesting place. I think Bunker Hill, which is, you know, run by the National Park Service and is a very dramatic place would be another place I would mention. You know, in the South, you know, Charleston was a huge battle, but Charleston has grown so much and is, you know, is no longer the little seaport of whatever it was, 10,000 people back in the day. So it's hard to even with your imagination, see what happened there, even though the good folks in Charleston have put up signage and done a good job. I think Guilford Courthouse, having been there, is very interesting. It's kind of a bite-sized battle. It's very important. Nathanael Greene is there. He loses the battle in the sense of the British hold the ground after the shooting stops, but it is a disastrous victory for the British. And again, there's good signage. It's pretty easy to get to in Greensboro. And I think is a real interesting view of what the fighting was like in the South in the latter stretch of the war.
I want to go back to the documentary for a moment. You mentioned Sarah Botstein, the co-director, earlier in the show, who you've been traveling with, and Ken Burns promoting it. Here's an excerpt from an appearance the two of you made. We're going to hear your thoughts first on what the revolution means, and then Sarah's perspective on finding experts to create a compelling and accurate history.
It's our creation myth, our creation story. It tells us who we are, where we came from, what our forebears believed, and what they were willing to die for. That's the most profound question any people can ask themselves.
One of the best parts of my job is to figure out who the historians are who have spent their lives studying this subject. Who is a scholar of this period in the war, who's a writer about this conflict, this battle. We take that story of the American Revolutionary War and we infuse it with interpretations of those moments with leading scholars on the subject. We have about 24 of them. Many of them are on camera, and they hold our feet to the fire the whole time. They want to get it right too.
I'm curious, what do you hope this film teaches Americans?
I hope it's an opportunity to reflect on, you know, where we came from, to pay tribute to those who came before us. I also hope that people remember that we're the beneficiary of enlightened political heritage handed down to us from that revolutionary generation. And it includes strictures that give us personal liberties and strictures on how to divide power and keep it from concentrating in the hands of authoritarians who think primarily themselves. That's a large part of what the war was about. And we can't allow that precious heritage to slip away or to be taken away. And we can't be oblivious to the hundreds of thousands who've given their lives to affirm and sustain it over the past 250 years. There is nothing that the founders feared more than tyranny. They didn't fear the British more than anything on the earth. They feared an authoritarian stripping them of the things that they considered to be the most vital for a successful, happy republic. And we should be aware of that.
Sarah mentioned holding everyone's feet to the fire, and we're talking about how the war is portrayed and what can be learned. Not sure if you saw the recent story by Jill Lepore in The New Yorker about how divided we are today over what's history, whose stories are told, and what the revolution means. And I'm curious whether those fights are anything new. It certainly seems like the Civil War never ended when it comes to interpretation and condemnation. Is the revolution just playing catch up?
Yeah, I did read that piece in The New Yorker. Yeah, it's not uncommon for any people to be quibbling and quarreling and sometimes, having fisticuffs over interpretations of the past, what the past means, who owns the past. And I don't think that we should be totally surprised that there are struggles and tussles over the revolution as we swing into the semi-quincentennial.
That rolled off the tongue, by the way. Impressive, Rick.
I've been practicing a lot. Sounds like a medical procedure, but it's actually the 250th anniversary of the country. Our interpretation of the Civil War still remains under fire. There are those who cling to the notion that it was driven by states' rights, when in fact it's really about slavery. A lot of the question of how to honor the Confederate dead and the statues of Lee and Stonewall Jackson and so on, should they come down, should they go back up? And all of that reflects this fact that the past, as Faulkner once said, isn't past. It's never past. So I think the revolution, has been quiescent for a while, partly because it is 250 years ago. But I think that, as with the bicentennial, I'm old enough to remember it well, the semi-quincentennial is going to be an opportunity to do some relitigating about it. And there's nothing wrong with that. It shows, first of all, that we care. If everybody just shrugged their shoulders and said ho-hum to another signal point in the country's history, God, we've lasted 250 years. Let's not say ho-hum. If we need to argue about it, fine, but let's not be indifferent.
No ho-hum, but I'm so glad you mentioned statues, Rick, because one of the things that stuck with me, I read the story that you recently wrote for The Atlantic about King George III and reinterpreting him. And, of course, anyone who knows anything about The British Are Coming, your first book, knows that you had access to papers that had long been unreleased, not made available to the public. So, but the detail that stood out to me about King George is that you write about American colonists erecting a statue of King George in Manhattan as a tribute after he repealed the Stamp Act. This was in, I think, 1766. 10 years later, they tear it down. They send the remains to Connecticut, where a group of women melt it down and make 42,088 bullets to shoot at King George's army. So how did the view of George change so much in that 10 years? But more importantly, how did you dig up this story? Because it's fascinating.
Yes, it's what we in the literary business call irony. Well, the story of pulling down the statue has been known for a long time, because those who did it, including some Continental Army soldiers, who had just heard for the first time a proclamation called the Declaration of Independence, it was read aloud in Manhattan. And the hoi polloi got so fired up that they took ropes and went down to what is today Battery Park and lassoed that equestrian statue of George III, who's dressed as a Roman emperor in a toga, much as the statue that exists today near Windsor Castle. And they yanked it off the pedestal and, as you say, cut it up and made bullets out of it. I had access. Queen Elizabeth II in late 2015 opened up to outside scrutiny as a part of a project to digitize and catalog the papers of all four Georges who became king in the 18th and 19th centuries. She opened it up to outside scholars, and I was one of the first allowed into Windsor Castle, where the papers are kept, to take a look. There are about 500,000 pages, most of them previously unpublished, and most of them from the reign of George III, because he was king for almost 60 years. And you really have a tactile sense of being in his presence, because until late in life, when he began to go blind, he wrote not only most of his correspondence himself, he made the copies himself. And you really see him as being a much more nuanced, interesting character than the American caricature, which happens to also be largely the British caricature. He's a constitutional monarch. He's a patriot king. He's a promoter of both the arts and the sciences. There's a lot about him that's admirable, including the fact that he's a good husband, which is not a given for 18th century monarchs. He's a caring father with those 15 kids from Queen Charlotte. You can disagree with him politically, for sure, but I find him very difficult to detest or simply dismiss as a reactionary autocrat or the sinister ninny who prances across the stage every night in Hamilton.
Well, sorry for the dad joke, but by George, that's going to have to be the last word. Rick Atkinson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Eric. I enjoyed the conversation.
Rick Atkinson's new book is The Fate of the Day. For Mike Collins, I'm Eric Spanberg. Thanks for listening to Charlotte Talks.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.